Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads, featuring illuminated manuscripts, metalwork, carvings, and works by contemporary Ethiopian artists. On view now. For tickets and more information, you can visit PEM.org.
And M&M Skylights, servicing Massachusetts and New Hampshire, their team is part of the Velux Skylight Specialist Network and is committed to helping improve the air quality in your home or business. You can learn more and schedule a consultation at mmskylights.com.
Trusted. Local. News. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, HD1 Boston, online at gbhnews.org. GBH News with NPR. What matters to you.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marge Regan, Jim Browdy. We're joined now on Zoom by Corby Kummer. Corby is the Executive Director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, Senior Editor at The Atlantic, and a Senior Lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hi, Corby.
Hello there.
Hello to you.
Hello, Corby Kummer. Great to talk to you. So here's the question from the Mother Jones piece. Can a vegetarian who doesn't eat meat eat cultivated meat made from the cells of animals? That seems to be the question.
I think we need Art Kaplan, the ethicist, for the...
Well, the best we could do is you, Corby, so you're here. You have to answer the question.
Okay, you're up. The question is whether you avoid eating animals because of animal welfare or strictly environment. If it's strictly animal welfare, and actually both, if it's animal welfare and environment, this cultured meat is taken from a live animal, they say. Big, big caveat for reading all the stories about tasting so far of cultivated meat, a ridiculous euphemism, meaning cell culture in a test tube, taking cells from a live animal, and then growing it out in a medium. Here's a dirty little secret. Almost invariably, the medium is fetal bovine serum, FVS, which is taken from dead cows and calves. So they never talk about the growing medium, they just talk about the live frolicking pig they took the cells from originally and grew them out in a test tube. It's almost impossible to find a synthesized medium, they're not economically viable yet. So this story in Mother Jones from Mission Barns, one of the big 80 or so, just in Silicon Valley alone, companies trying to do cultivated meat, they don't say anything about the growth medium. So presumably it's animal welfare that would make you feel good about, even if you were a vegetarian, not harming a dead animal. So that part's good. Environmental footprint's gonna be much, much lower because something like 85% of agriculture greenhouse gas emissions are from beef and beef raising. But the big problems are, what are the energy requirements for this? Almost everything I've read by investigative reporters say that these Silicon Valley people are just pulling the wool over people's eyes, that they're using a ton of the plant-based meat, synthesized stuff, pea proteins and such, as the filler and a couple of the cells, because it doesn't make any economic sense so far to be able to scale this. But the ethical question is still the reason that these companies hang on and raise hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, but you're saying the ethical question is miscast by most people, aren't you?
Oh, completely. Yes. I don't think they're actually anywhere near making these things economically viable. And I don't think they have found a non-animal growth serum and growth medium to grow this stuff out.
Really glad we brought it up.
Just a quick question. Jim said he had a plant burger from Whole Foods and it tasted very good.
It was fabulous.
And that's great.
Last week.
But I guess I just don't get this whole thing with the fake meat. Why not just eat nuts, legumes, you know, chickpeas?
Because I like the taste of a hamburger. And a nut doesn't taste like a hamburger.
Well,
and this tasted like a hamburger.
But I mean, I don't know. Does the plant burger really taste like a hamburger?
Yes, it did.
By
the way, am I as fairly discerning when it comes to food?
You are fairly discerning, but you eat a lot.
Or am I fairly discerning? Is that the question?
Yes, that's what Jim says. He's fairly discerning.
It tasted like a hamburger, and I like the taste of a hamburger.
You think it can taste like a hamburger too, Corby?
You know, isn't this role reversal between the two of you?
Yes,
not
it
to
is.
Get personal. The idea is, with the plant-based burgers, it's how much you like the taste of meat. The fundraising premise behind these companies that raise hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to do this cell culture meat is that regular people are always going to be able to tell the difference. They're never going to be satisfied with a plant-based burger. It's not so much what it says on the label, it's what's in the mouth. They want meat, like meat, we're programmed to like meat. They're always going to be able to tell the difference. Give them what they want.
Well, let me just say, it's getting better because you, I think, were the first person that introduced us to whatever. I don't know if it was Impossible or what it was.
Beyond
at the
Meat,
library.
Maybe, I forget.
And I was modestly impressed. Marjorie spit it out, actually, right on the set, which was disgusting, I should say. I've tried probably 100 of them, and this is the first one where at the end I was able to say it tasted like a hamburger and had the texture of a hamburger.
Maybe you just
What's
eat
your problem?
Lentils instead.
No, lentil doesn't taste like a hamburger.
I don't know
if I want a lentil, I'll have a lentil.
But it just seems so weird. It's like fake meat. I guess that's what I can't get my head around. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What Kim is describing is the huge evolution in the development from the
awful
burger phase.
Yes.
Much, much better simulations. And what was the brand of the first plausible one?
I don't know. You brought it to us. Oh, no, just the place,
Plant
I think,
Burger.
Is called
Whole
Plant
Foods.
Burger at Whole Foods at the
Burger.
Ink Spot. Ink Spot, is that what it's called?
PLNT, right?
Yeah, PL, yes.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. That's a guy named Seth Goldman who started Honest Tea and is the chair of the board of Beyond Meat. It's mostly Beyond products, and he has started an in-store restaurant chain. Maybe they're only at Whole Foods, but I'm really glad there's a Plant Burger in Boston. I didn't know there was one of their locations.
It was really good. It was quite good. And by the way, if I may... I was introduced by whoever was running the thing through a chicken nugget, and this was not close to a chicken nugget. This tasted exactly. What are you looking at me like this for? It tasted exactly. Oh, if you don't want the real chicken nugget, have a lentil. I didn't want a lentil. I wanted a chicken nugget, and it tasted like a chicken
nugget. I like that Jim is the regular guy on the street.
That's right. I didn't say you had to have a lentil, Jim.
No, but you said why not have
could
a lentil? Because I didn't want a lentil.
Could have had a chickpea.
Excuse me. Do you have any lentils? Beans? Actually, I don't want a lentil. I take that back. Can I have one of those fake chicken nuggets that tastes exactly like a chicken nugget?
We are moving on
My
now.
My God.
We're moving on.
We are?
Yes. We have read terrible things the last couple of weeks about what's in our food. Last week we were talking about the lead and the baby food.
That is unbelievable.
And then we had the terrible crisis with the all these foodborne illness crises and the baby formula shortage and stuff. So what's the FDA doing to try to restore its tattered reputation?
They're trying to consolidate the dysfunctional division of departments dealing with food within the FDA. And they're trying to say, we're going to have a deputy commissioner of food safety, which is something that advocates have been calling for years and years, and they've never done. They're recognizing the inefficiency and the internecine, I never know how to pronounce that word, squabbles,
right.
The interdepartment squabbles that have kept things like baby food scandals from rising to the level of the people who should be investigating and regulating it. So Robert Califf, the commissioner of the FDA, admitted this week in the press release calling for this new deputy commissioner, these new consolidated offices, that these are parts of a jigsaw puzzle within FDA that don't fit together. So it's really good that they're doing it. I don't know enough for my guru, Helena Bademiller-Evich, who in Politico last April, did a very hard-hitting expose of the years and years of inefficiency, lost action, and deaths caused by this inefficiency and underfunding within FDA. It's her reporting that has led to this. Everyone, nobody makes a secret of it. That goes through the scandal. But so far, some of the critics are saying, unless this new food czar within FDA has regulatory authority, which is what the FDA is, it's a regulatory agency, and Califf, the head, in announcing this, is saying they still don't have regulatory authority, that's the big cudgel. That's the weapon that can get food companies to come into compliance quick. So it remains to be seen whether it's as one Bill Marler, who's a great guy on food safety, says it's rearranging the deck chairs. But it's still some kind of progress because the FDA is in real trouble. But it's mostly money. So the new person will have control of $320 million budget. That sounds great, but the budget of the FDA is $6.1 billion. has 1.1 billion max, and 320 million is like nothing compared to the control the new food czar should have.
Hey, by the way, I'm sorry to go back to this. Did you say the plant burger is PLNT? I just looked it up. Is that right?
PLNT without the A.
Without the A, you're right. PLNT, and the only place in Boston it appears is the, what do you mean, okay? Is it the Whole Food, Whole Foods Market? Thank you for that. So it appears that the pandemic, well, we knew, we've discussed this with you or somebody else before, that a lot of bread making by people who'd never made bread, I was not one of them, but that there is a run on bread making machines now. I had a bread making machine about 30 years ago, one of the first. I used it once, and I was no, I'm serious. I'm putting my, because it was, but they're good, and it's huge now. It's like a real, it's not even a fad. It's a trend, whatever that is. Yeah, right?
The story behind the new resurgence and selling out of bread machines when they hit the shelves is TikTok. If you look at this, it's all fueled by TikTok videos. So those of us who are TikTok illiterate, of course, I wouldn't include the two of you, but I will say it includes me, have to find out what's going on with spreading trends and influencers on TikTok, because there have been a lot of influencers who have been saying, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread.
But I'm bummed, thank you.
Get one of these. The reasons given in this Time story about the business resurgence, it is a resurgence in the sales, is sales of loaves of bread are going up to $7. And you can make a loaf for $3 to $4. One of the company spokespeople says, it's great to have convenience, but when you're actually saving money for people, that's when they'll start buying something. I'm not even sure I agree with that, but that's the theory behind this. You can get them in thrift shops, which a lot of the happy consumers in the story have done. And suddenly they're getting $3 to $4 for the loaf, or it's $60 to $120. What I recall from the old fashioned bread machines is it's underdeveloped flavor. You know, one of them says, one of the people who says, it's the most dense, yummy, most delicious bread you'll ever have. Dense does not go with yummy when it comes to bread in my mind, but it is what I remember from bread machines. And maybe, Jim, that's what you remember.
You ever had a bread machine?
Sorry?
You ever had a bread machine?
I've never owned one, but I've used them.
Okay, fine.
I used to make bread, but I used it the old-fashioned way where you pounded down the...
Which is therapeutic.
It's very therapeutic. I really enjoyed making bread.
Were you listening last week when Marty told the story about how her stomach almost exploded when she was at the ashram at Stanford and she forgot she ate the bread before it had risen?
Okay.
Were you what? I mean, okay, I'm telling the story. Are you familiar with that story?
I'm very familiar with it.
Oh, you are.
Enjoy telling, Jim. Not
I
Mark.
Do.
He's told it quite a few times.
Is it true or is it not true?
I wasn't at the ashram. I was in Theta Chi, the place I lived.
What was Theta Chi?
That was the place I lived at.
Whoa.
It was an old fraternity house.
You lived at a fraternity house?
Yes, but it was a co-ed fraternity house.
Yeah, I bet it
okay.
was.
Okay, here's we had these gentlemen, these comfort food guys who've opened up down at Upham's Corner in
it's
Dorchester.
Not comfort food guys. The restaurant is called Comfort Kitchen.
Comfort Kitchen.
It's not
Whoops.
Comfort food
comfort
guys.
Kitchen.
International comfort food.
Yeah, international comfort food. And it's with Bilal Rai and...
Biplaw to you.
And Kwesi Kwa from Comfort Kitchen. Okay, in this clip, Rai is talking about the dining experience and what he makes of Marjorie's picky eating. That would be me.
I saw something online that said, you know, service is a black and white photo. Mm-hmm. Hospitality is a colorful painting. We're trying to create something that is, you know, the food experience is so much more than just food.
Speaking of boring eater, I want one of you to be honest. What do you think when Marjorie said, I've never had duck in my life?
This is leading a boring life.
Exactly. And by the way, how much did you love the duck they brought to the library? Was that great?
It was great, but I do lead a boring life, particularly when it comes to food. I don't want to eat anything too exotic. But anyway, this is kind of exciting. These guys are two immigrants who are talking about a variety of food, Senegalese food, and foods from different parts of the world that they're offering up down in Upham's Corner.
I think it's fantastically exciting. First, if they're bringing something like fine dining to Upham's Corner, which needs it. They want the community to support it, that they're celebrating food of different immigrant communities and trying what I would say is a very steep mountain to climb, which is to make it as authentic as possible mm-hmm. to the actual region it comes from. That's so hard and it's so fraught, but I wish them all the luck in the world. And the idea, I think that by calling it comfort kitchen, first of all, the food of your own home and your own home country, if you came from somewhere else, is what will invariably be the most comforting. But the idea that we, who didn't grow up with it, but are maybe more adventurous eaters than Marjorie, can go and try to experience this. They're trying so hard to have a worldwide range on their menu, and I think they're gonna try to be sort of true and accurate to the groups that have come to the Boston community. But it's incredibly exciting. It's incredibly ambitious to do this at Upham's Corner, which hasn't supported this kind of dining before. And I not only wish them all the luck in the world, I want us to keep talking about it on this show with like personal experience so we can say we've been, it's great.
By the way, personal experience is gonna be mine in the next few days. I have a reservation. Just listen to this description in Boston Eater. Comfort Kitchen's Yassa Chicken, a Senegalese stew that is found throughout West Africa, uses common South Asian spices like turmeric, is that how you pronounce it, or turmeric, and coriander, and Kwa, one of the leaders, there are actually six of them involved in this, not just the two we mentioned, serves the chicken with pillowy cassava dumplings. I mean,
I like
if you
the
look
pillowy
at,
part.
If you look at the menu for this thing, it really is international, all over the world, comfort food. It sounds fabulous, and I'll report back next week. You know, before you go, Corby, you ever had Four Loko?
No, and boy, this story of a lot of personal testimonials makes me hope I never do.
Well, yeah. Here's, you want to play a sound from this? Here's a recent article from Punch, which publication covers the alcohol industry, reminisces about the zeitgeist that the malt beverage Four Loko triggered during, I think it was the 2010s. And if you're not familiar, Four Loko is this mix of malt liquor and caffeine. It became known as a blackout in a can. I guess I shouldn't laugh. Here's a clip from SNL 10 years ago where Jason Sudeikis impersonates the company founder. Here it is.
5 years ago, me and my Ohio State bros figured, you know, we were like, we love getting drunk, but we can only get so drunk because we kept passing out. So we tried drinking Jack and Coke, but I don't like Jack. My Coke dealer got busted. So, you know, we came up with Four Loko. You know, I don't think it's that crazy of a product. It's not crazy. Why is it crazy?
By the way, it was a bunch of kids from freshmen or something from Ohio State that came up with this thing.
Yeah, a lot of speed uppers in it and a higher alcohol content. I think it was 12% alcohol
they
or something.
They doubled it, yeah.
Yeah, and people were blacking out and people were... blood pressure is going through the roof and people are getting sick to their stomachs. And I don't even know if can you even still get it. I don't even know.
Why is it in the news, Corby?
You still get Four Loko without the ingredients that turbocharged it, which were caffeine, taurine, and one other. They were made in November of 2010. Caffeine, guarana, and taurine, all of them uppers. And they had to take it out. But they still make malt beverages and aren't particularly different. I remember because The Atlantic had its food channel then, and we covered it a lot in 2009 and 2010. It's about risk taking, and it's about wanting to get intoxicated fast. And, you know, in this oddly ambivalent, I kind of wanted to try it piece by this author. He or she said, you know, I had a couple of sips, and boy, did I know I'd had something incredibly intoxicating. Two more, and I would have gone over the edge. So it's this flirting with danger, and a cocktail expert says it was always like, hey, did you hear about this new thing New York City is banning? Or hey, you hear about the kid who died drinking Four Loko? Let's drink it. It appealed to exactly that ethos of risk taking.
I'm really glad we're promoting it then. If that's the we're not promoting, I don't want to be clear. We are
not
whatever we're
it's
doing.
Not a good idea.
We're decisively analyzing it.
We are. Thank you very much. Corby, it's a joy to talk to you.
Thank
as
you,
always.
Corby.
Thank you so much for your time.
We've been speaking with Corby Kummer, Executive Director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute.
I'm buying you a plant burger, by the way.
Buy me a plant burger. A senior editor at The Atlantic and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Up next, another edition of Afternoon Zoo with Sy Montgomery.
Listen to your voice.
Well, I love talking to her. She is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.